The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
This is SiriusXM Progress. I'm John Fugelsang. Welcome to the Love Fest. That is Tell Me Everything. Chris Hauselt's our executive producer, running this thing out of the South Carolina Bureau. The great Thea Harper runs it out of Brooklyn. I am so pleased to be with you. We have a packed show tonight. We're going to be talking with Simon Moya-Smith and Julie Francella for our First Nations segment. Also, author David Mascriotra is going to be here to talk about his incredible new book about the exurbs and how technically that is the area you should be keeping your eye on. We've talked about white flight from the cities to the suburbs, but we haven't begun to talk about the white flight from the suburbs to the exurbs and why it's a scary phenomenon. Also, Dina Dahl will be here in hour number three to talk about today's famous departure. We have so much to get to. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries told reporters his caucus will not be helping Mike Johnson get past the Republican FISA blockade as Trump's little Johnson tries to find a plan B. A lot of prominent Democratic lawmakers are not on board with these calls for Sonia Sotomayor to retire in the next 6 months. Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, meanwhile, a liberal in Wisconsin, announced that she will retire from the Wisconsin Supreme Court at the end of this term. That means the razor-thin liberal majority in the court once again falls to the hands of voters. Last year, young people saved it with heavy voter turnout in an off-year election. What's going to happen when everyone shows up to vote this November? Also, in a twist, the Trump campaign says they want to debate Joe Biden and they want to do it sooner and more often than the past election year debate schedules when, well, Trump had COVID, so they only did it twice. Hamas may not have enough living hostages to make a deal for a ceasefire. And the CDC has told us that measles is on the edge of becoming endemic in the United States once again. Let's take some time to thank Robert Kennedy Jr. and Donald Trump and all the men who made that possible. Measles had been eradicated for decades before our know-nothing anti-vax movement gained strength through the pandemic. And also today, a recent CDC report has debunked the widespread misinformation about the COVID-19 vaccines causing fatal heart attacks in teens and young adults. The analysis found no evidence linking the vaccines to sudden cardiac deaths among previously healthy young people. This comes as there's a relief amidst the ongoing concerns about the safety of vaccines, especially in light of the pandemic, but the CDC's findings support the safety and efficacy of the vaccines. Oh, and by the way, we're not losing 3,000 Americans to COVID in hospital hallways anymore every day. It's OJ time. I never thought I'd be talking about this guy on this show, but the Hall of Fame athlete turned actor turned, well, you know, a guy whose murder trial literally changed American culture and American media, has died at the age of 76 of prostate cancer. Now, I know what you're all wondering. Is the tumor okay? I know. Let's talk about OJ. Let's talk about it tonight, because if you're like me, this has been a part of your consciousness most of your life. And of course, this June marks the 30-year anniversary of the murders. A lot of us grew up with this. A lot of us have lived with this story for a very long time. And I want to know, how do you feel this has changed your culture? How did this change our media? How did it change our politics? For Americans of a certain age, all you need to know is O.J. Simpson died. I mean, you know, we know the story. Heisman Trophy 1968 at USC. Buffalo Bills, Football Hall of Fame, and then actually made the transition from sports to celebrity. He was a successful actor. He was very funny in the Naked Gun movies, Capricorn One, and TV Pitchman. We all remember the Hertz ads, right? He used to say, "I'm not black, I'm OJ." That's what OJ said. And then he was accused of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman, June 12th, 1994 in L.A. And then, of course, there was the televised slow-speed car chase in 1994 with OJ in a white Ford Bronco and police in pursuit. And that really was it. It sort of feels like the world started speeding up then. And the rest of the OJ story was just pummeled into our eyes and our ears for the next 3 years. The double murder trial changed how we cover news. It was the first time we really saw a criminal trial that captured the entire news media 24/7, like eclipsing all other news. I wasn't alive for the Lindbergh baby. I'm sure it was something like this, but that was the legacy. I mean, it began with the Gulf War. The first Gulf War, the popular Gulf War to restore the dictator of Kuwait, when that was broadcast live round the clock and it was ratings gold. And then in 1995, it was the Bronco and it was OJ. I will never forget. I was in a dorm room watching game 5 of the NBA Finals and they cut away from the NBA. It was tied. They cut away from the NBA Finals. If you're under the age of 30, it's really hard to explain how, if you weren't captivated by that news story, your culture was. You couldn't escape it. He was in the Bronco and he wrote a note. "I've had a great life, great friends. Please think of the real OJ and not this lost person." Everybody thought that was a suicide note at the time, but it wasn't. And he went to trial. And it was the trial of the century. And we all remember Johnny Cochran and a few other guys who aren't with us anymore, who turned the bloody glove into the most famous trial prop in history. The evidence at the murder scene was overwhelmingly against him, and yet he was unconvictable. I'll never forget William Kunstler, the legendary liberal lawyer, before he died, said that O.J. Simpson was unconvictable before the trial began. There, the bloody footprints in his size were there. Blood drops matching his DNA was there, and a glove that was the same style as one that was bought by his ex-wife and worn by him on camera at some football games. And then there was another glove that was smeared with blood that was found at his home. And this is back when DNA analysis was a very new thing. There were a lot of mistakes by the cops, a lot of mistake by forensics. And of course, the famous image when he tried to get the gloves on in court, they wouldn't fit on his hands. Johnny Cochran delivered a certain line. He was unconvictable. He was horribly abusive to this woman, psychologically and physically. When it came to murder, they were unwavering in saying he was innocent. And of course, we got to learn all about Mark Furman, the cop who found the bloody glove, who denied ever making any anti-black comments. And then they found the recordings of him going N-word this, N-word that. And Officer Furman later had to plead guilty to perjury. And the racist, lying, perjuring cop was the one who found the bloody glove at O.J. Simpson's home, or put it there. Either way, it was clear that Detective Furman could not be trusted, and the jury agreed. And I agreed. My dad was the only white guy in his town down south who agreed with this at the time. Didn't say that he was innocent, but they broke the timeline. So he was acquitted of the murder, and it tore people apart. And the media talked a lot about racial lines. They didn't talk about gender lines. Didn't talk about the fact that this was sort of a story about race, but it was about a man who would say he transcended race. "I'm not black, I'm OJ." And of course, it's a story about police brutality and how police frame people. But it wasn't a poor black man. It was a wealthy black man with overwhelming privilege that showed you could buy a not guilty verdict. Now, of course, the jury in the civil trial did find him liable for the killings. He had to pay $33.5 million to the family of Ms. Brown and Mr. Goldman. He had to auction off his Heisman Trophy, got about $250,000 for that. He never did pay off the $33 million. He said he just lived on his NFL and private pensions. And then 12 years later, when all of this has kind of died down, Rupert Murdoch, when News Corp owned HarperCollins, approved an OJ book where he gave his hypothetical version of the killings called If I Did It. And people were so outraged that Murdoch had to cancel the book. Ron Goldman's family won control of the manuscript, and they published it, retitling it, If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer. And of course, later he served 9 years in prison for his role in a botched armed robbery. Just a middle-aged man trying to get his balls back. Here's 2 months ago, O.J. Simpson's on Twitter, and it's weird and it's ghoulish. And he posted this video of him 2 months ago, before the Super Bowl, laughing off anybody suggesting that he might somehow not be well. Give a quick listen to this.
Hey, X-World. Hospice? Hospice? You talking about hospice? No, I'm not in any hospice. I don't know who put that out there, but whoever put that out there, I guess it's like the Donald Sink. Can't trust the media. In any event, I'm hosting a ton of friends.
There you go. That's O.J. Simpson 2 months ago letting us know how healthy he is. As of today, he is dead. Now, it's going to get more interesting because we're going to be learning more in the next few days. We've already learned stuff, really interesting stuff. There's a posting on Twitter. Chris, I don't have the woman's name. Do you have her name? It's an amazing story. Let me get it. It's
Source it real quick.
Nicole Minette,
you're right.
Nicole Minette. So Nicole Minette did a posting earlier, which is going to be in the news. She said she's been waiting 29 years to tell this story about OJ and his days at USC. And now that he's dead, I have a story that I signed an NDA for that is no longer valid. She was a junior at USC, working in Topping Student Center on the campus in 1995. She was an administrative assistant to the president of student affairs that semester in the work study program. And in early 1995, who walks in but two of OJ's lawyers, Robert Shapiro and USC alum Robert Kardashian. And you know what they did? They had an appointment with her boss. She said she was studying to be a criminal defense lawyer with a dual major in poli-sci and international relations. She knew who they were. The meeting was about 30 minutes, and she was shocked. And afterwards, she tells a story that her boss walked her outside and lit a cigarette for the first time in years and told her she had to sign an NDA because she could confirm that OJ's lawyers were there at USC for a meeting. And then he told her what the meeting was about. Before OJ Simpson could graduate from USC, the university had to pay off two families of two girls, both white, both blonde, that he had dated, that he had battered. And they both went to the LAPD to report it. One said he also sexually assaulted her during their relationship. Now, this school really wanted OJ to go far in football. He was the pride and joy of USC, and they did not want to see his legacy destroyed, so they protected their investment. At this point, you know, OJ in 1995 had been in custody for 6 months. Lawyers were in the discovery process for the trial. And Robert Kardashian knew OJ because they were at USC together. And he thought it would be really good if those stories never saw the light of day. So they wrote a big check. They gave it to her boss. They left. People signed NDAs. They paid to cover up that he had previously beaten up and abused two different girls. She says, I'll never forget holding that check. Now, did you hear about this before now? Nope. That's how much power money enables. I want you to think about this in the days to come. I talk a lot about, hypothetically, when Donald Trump shuffles off this mortal coil. And I'll say it again. I don't want Donald Trump to die. I'm not wishing for him to die. I want three ghosts to visit Donald Trump on Christmas Eve and turn him into a good person. That's what I want. But he's going to go. The hideous anus-like lips will stop flapping. Donald Trump will be gone. And when he is gone, and there's a box in a hearse on a tarmac somewhere, and they cut into your TV shows to show the box being driven. When there's the funeral, Donald Trump's gauche funeral, because you know Melania's bringing a date, and the casket's going to look like Liberace's piano, and Frank Stallone's going to sing. You know that. Scott Baio and the MyPillow guy and Ron Jeremy are all going to be pallbearers. When that's all over, everyone Trump made sign an NDA is going to start talking. And folks, as much as I want you to stay healthy and stay alive so you're here to watch Donald Trump's funeral with me, I'll be live tweeting it. I want even more you to live a few months after his funeral when all the NDAs come home to roost. Now, Alan Dershowitz just said in an interview today that he thought OJ was probably guilty when he watched the police chase in 1994. I was watching the NBA Finals or the NBA playoffs when it happened. I said to my family when I was watching, looks like he's probably guilty. Otherwise, why would he be running away? And then they offered him money. So he took the case. And it was amazing. I mean, Johnny Cochran, F. Lee Bailey, it was incredible to watch. The O.J. Simpson's legal team. I mean, we all got a civics lesson watching that. Dershowitz said it was the nightmare team. They were all fighting with each other, but Dershowitz got paid. Now, if I had a time machine, there's a lot of things I'd do. I'd go back in time and I'd buy Hitler's paintings. I'd let him think he was a really successful artist and he should stay with it. That's what I would do. I'd get him into weed so he'd be less motivated. You know, things like that. But you know what else I would do with the time machine? I would stop OJ from killing those people. Because then nobody would ever know what a Kardashian is. And I say OJ killed those people because I assume he knows who did it. If he didn't do it, he knows who did it. There have been many rumors over the years about who did it. You can look all those up. But just remember, O.J. Simpson is the reason we have these awful, materialistic, dumb Kardashians. These Kardashians that just consume, 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 consume. That shop, that celebrate materialism, that celebrate being dumb. I mean, I appreciate Kim going to law school, dynamite, good for you. But if O.J. hadn't been friends with Robert Kardashian, the man who got him off for murder, the man who covered up his battery of women, we would have never heard of any of those people, all the KKKs. Kanye West might have imploded a decade sooner. In fact, Keeping Up with the Kardashians was originally titled Mundane Rituals of Vapid Materialists Famous Because OJ Killed Two People. So here we are. OJ Simpson is going to hell, but he's only going there to continue his search for the real killer. And there's going to be a lot of analyses about what all this means and what it says about all of us as a people. And I'd love to know your thoughts. We're going to talk to Dina Dahl in hour three about it, too. I think the O.J. Bronco chase paved the way for the O.J. Bronco chase of presidencies. That's what the Trump years were. It was like an O.J. Bronco chase in the White House, except we all got dragged into the Bronco. And Al Cowlings was speaking Russian. Really quick before our break, Joe Biden has announced a new order that closes the gun show loophole. Ordinarily, this would be the big news of the day. It's going to expand federal background checks to firearms sold outside firearms retailers, including at gun shows and online. Thousands of gun sellers would have to register as federally licensed firearms dealers under the new rules the administration issued today. It's the biggest expansion of background checks in decades. And yes, they're going to sue to try to stop. But again, Joe Biden just announced his huge student loan forgiveness plan earlier in the week that'll affect more than 30 million people after the Supreme Court struck down Biden's original student loan debt cancellation plan next year. Biden's also considering an executive order that would make it a lot harder for migrants to claim asylum over here. And he's doing it all through his pen. He's daring the courts to try to go after him on these new executive actions. But I'll take the actions on gun control. It's intended to close the gun show loophole and all the online sale loopholes. And it's going to force anybody who sells a gun for profit to register with the federal government. I mean, because of those loopholes, there's about 20,000 dealers operating without licenses who are not required to conduct background checks. This is good. This will save lives. We just learned that nearly a quarter of K-12 teachers experienced a lockdown because of a gun or suspicions of a gun at their school last year. A quarter of K-12 teachers. Now, I went to public school, but I think that's 25%. 8% of teachers polled said they'd been in more than one gun-related lockdown last year. The number of school shootings broke records in 2021, broke them again in 2022, broke them again in 2023. 69% of teachers said the best way to prevent school shootings would be to improve mental health screening and treatment. Only 13% want teachers and administrators to be able to carry guns. So this is progress. This new rule is going to require thousands more gun dealers to run background checks on buyers. That's going to be very unpopular, but it will save lives. So on a day we say goodbye to OJ and remember what he was famous for, let's applaud the efforts to reduce gun violence, because we have the power to stop unnecessary killings if we decide we want to. And we want to know what you guys think. We're at 866-997-4748. 866-997-GRIT. We'll be back in just a moment with your calls and author David Mascriota about Exurbia Now. Don't go away. This is Progress.
Oh. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You know, we've talked a lot about white flight, how it drove people out of the cities into the suburbs, but we've moved beyond that. It's time to talk about Exurbia, arguably the most important battleground for candidates to try to win this year. It's home to people like Jim Jordan or Marjorie Taylor Greene or big mega churches or big chain restaurants or big box retailers or monster trucks. Exurbia has quietly become our greatest political battleground in the last three to four decades, and it's arguably more important to American politics than urban America or rural America. David Mascioltra is an author and a lecturer and a journalist. He writes regularly for The Progressive, the LA Review of Books, Crime Reads, No Depression. He's written for Salon, The Daily Beast, CNN. I was so excited to hear about his book and to get him on the show because he lives in an exurb outside of Chicago, and I've been a fan of his stuff in The Progressive and Salon. But his new book is going to blow your mind. It is Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. And it's all about these parts of the country that we don't talk about that may well decide the future of power in our nation. It's a great pleasure to welcome David Mascioltra to SiriusXM.
Pleasure's all mine, and thank you very much for that kind and generous introduction.
Well, it's fascinating to me because I'm someone who fled the suburbs for the city years ago. And so I think I've got to get the most obvious question out of the way. And I want to apologize, sir, because I know you're asked this at the start of every interview you've done for your book tour. But for the sake of our listeners, can we talk about what Exurbia is? You know, how does it differ from suburbia? These are more like planned communities for people who are leaving the suburbs, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So to start in the most elementary terms, we can break it down into distance and density. An exurb has greater distance from the nearest metro area, but less population density, that is fewer people. And exurbia used to be rural. So it used to be much more bucolic. Trailer parks were there. They were impoverished. But once people started to flee the cities and flee the suburbs in an attempt to escape diversity and escape an increasingly, in some places, progressive suburbia, so a later stage of white flight, real estate development firms and others began to build up planned communities in exurbia. So now they resemble middle-class suburbs, but they tend to be homogeneous. The economic landscape is entirely corporate, and they lack any type of shared space for communal gathering or camaraderie. And what you have are communities of isolation and communities of paranoia and prejudice. And it's for those reasons that it is exurbia, where support for Donald Trump is at the highest. And also, it's for those reasons that the most extreme, rabid, psychotic members of Congress, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, represent districts that are predominantly exurban.
Now, what are the factors, though, that make the exurbs so attractive to our deeply right-wing friends?
Well, one is that it's a refuge, that it's the last destination of escape. If the cities are too diverse and progressive, and suburbia is becoming more diverse and moving in a direction that's more progressive, they need somewhere to go. And exurbia is what remains as the perhaps final option. But at the same time, exurban communities often have lower property taxes. This is one of the dark secrets of county and state economics, in that new developments have lower property taxes than older neighborhoods. So there's an economic incentive there as well, attracting as a magnet. And that in itself creates its own right-wing echo chamber, because then the people who move there say, isn't this wonderful? We have these low taxes. It's not like in Chicago or the nearest Chicago suburbs, where you have all of those people abusing welfare and looking for handouts. Here, we earn our keep and we pay low taxes, when in reality, the taxes are low because it's new infrastructure, needs less maintenance, less development, and there are fewer teachers, fewer police officers, fewer firefighters, fewer librarians, and so on and so forth.
But you're saying the urban centers that they flee are still driving those states' economies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Donald Trump won almost every exurban county in the United States, and yet the counties that went for Joe Biden represent 71% of commercial activity in the United States. So without those city centers and without those densely populated suburbs, the American economy would crash almost instantly. Another factor that attracts right-wing exurbanites to exurbia is the high number of megachurches. Most megachurches are in exurbia, and that began as a practical matter. It's difficult to build a church the size of a basketball arena in a densely populated suburb or in the middle of Washington, D.C. or Miami. So in exurbia, there's the open space and the land is cheap. Well, now that the mega churches are there and they essentially function as national headquarters for Christian nationalism, they too act as a magnet, attracting like-minded people to those areas. And when those people become devout and they want to live near the institution where they gather some purpose and belonging and a sense of politics and participation, they move to that town or they move to a neighboring town. Right. So it's for all of these reasons that the exurbs now function as an enclave, as of right-wing authoritarian politics.
So they move there because it's more like the good old days, pre-feminism, pre-civil rights, pre-LGBTQ rights.
That's exactly it. They're attempting to, and this is the hopeful part of the book, Exurbia Now, that the movement is reactionary and reactive, and they're attempting to escape the progress made possible by participatory democracy, the progress of the civil rights movement, the progress of the feminist movement, the progress of what began as the gay rights movement, we now refer to as the LGBTQ movement. So in an attempt to create these enclaves, they're also trying to restore what they believe is the true America, the America before all of those movements put us on a path toward equality and justice and shared freedom and prosperity. And because it's not working, it's in the book, I describe it as fight or flight. They took flight, but it's not working. A clock only moves in one direction. They've entered into the fight mode of political engagement. And that's what Donald Trump represents. That's what those congressmen and women I mentioned earlier represent. And that's what media figures like Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon represent. An adversarial reaction morphed into hostility against democracy and against the mechanisms of expanding and enlarging freedom within the American experience.
And again, it's not rural. It's areas that used to be considered rural, but now it's ex-rural. The Wall Street Journal reports that median household income in exurbia is 15% higher than in suburbia. So again, we have to stress these are not backwoods, low-income Trump supporters.
Yeah, that's a very important point, because the mainstream media obsessively focuses on the rural voters. They perhaps see them as exotic and worthy of study, like the opening scenes of Deliverance or something out of a country music song, when in reality, and of course, many of those people do support Donald Trump, that they're an important part of his coalition. But in reality, the most important part of his coalition are these exurban voters and voters in the suburbs of small metro areas, cities like Peoria and Grand Rapids. First of all, there are more of them. So electorally, they're more significant. But second, as you just note, and as I report in the book, they have more money. So they can donate to campaigns, they can subscribe to right-wing podcasts, they can support right-wing media, they can financially support the Republican Party. And to look at why people who are not economically struggling, who are not poorly educated, are supporting a movement toward right-wing authoritarianism, forces much more introspection and engagement with the failures of American culture and the failures of our political system.
Sure.
These aren't backwoods rubes, but these are people who are within the American mainstream. And that even extends all the way to studies into the January 6th insurrectionists. One fascinating piece of research that I write about is the most common characteristic of someone who participated in the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021, was residency in an exurban county where the non-white population is growing.
And you'd think the media would pick up on this. You'd think we'd hear about this.
You would think so. And of course, the media at the onset after January 6 was quick to call the rioters, the insurrectionists, working class. This was a cry of blue-collar workers. But what subsequent, more thorough examination has uncovered is that most of the people who participated in that aborted insurrection were middle class. They were small business owners. They were tradesmen, but very successful in the trades, making upward of 80, 90 grand per year. So it contradicts this picture of economics as the driver of Trump support. It's not economics, it's culture, it's identity, it's Christian nationalism.
I mean, the media always fed us this line about economic anxiety, but the reality in 2016 was the poorest Americans overwhelmingly went for Secretary Clinton. So this is something the corporate media likes to run with. I am so grateful you're going deeper on it. Where do these folks work, sir? They live in the exurbs. Do they work in the suburbs or work in the cities, or do they have their own businesses in exurbia?
Many of them have their own businesses, but those who don't, and even some of those who do, tend to work in suburbia. So if they are living, say, 70 miles outside of Chicago, they're often working in the suburbs 15 or 20 miles out of Chicago. They're working in the suburbs that they fled. And this is even true of the business owners, because oftentimes they started their business in those suburbs. They built a customer base. They established a clientele. But then they leave. However, many of their customers are still there. And then another interesting thing that happens with the business owners is sometimes they reopen their business. They relocate the business to exurbia, but they keep the same name. So, for example, I grew up in a town called Lansing, Illinois, and there was a business there called Lansing Cleaners. Now, Lansing, I should say, is a south suburb of Chicago, about 20 miles out of the city. Now, Lansing Cleaners is far out there in exurbia, but it's still called Lansing Cleaners. So there's this interesting dynamic happening where even though they escape the suburbs, they're still dependent upon the suburbs for customers and according to what they've already established with their reputation.
I mean, I have to say, I grew up half Brooklyn, half Southern, but raised in the suburbs. And these folks remind me of an awful lot of people that were right wing that I grew up around. But it seems like when we talk about how the exurbs have transformed over the past decades, maybe we need to talk about how they've transformed over the past election cycles. Is it tied to our politics, or are our politics a reflection of these shifts in where we live?
It's a little bit of both, and I'm not trying to punt on the question. It's a great question. But it's a little bit of both, because the geography matters as an impetus for these political changes, because when people become more isolated, they tend to become more extreme in their politics.
Yeah.
Robert Putnam, the author of Bowling Alone, reports on that where isolation lives, extremism thrives. But once they're there, they enter into a closed circuit world. So one thing about exurbia is that it's often a news desert. So they don't have local media. As I already said, they don't have shared communal space. Oftentimes the residency neighborhoods where they live don't even have sidewalks. So they're living these lives of isolation, and then they become increasingly susceptible to the fear and paranoia and often outright hatred that they receive from right-wing media.
Yep.
And that enhances the very beliefs of exclusion and the very politics of paranoia and prejudice that drove them to exurbia in the first place.
Now, Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone talks about how we used to be a nation of joiners, that we had bowling leagues and we'd all go out and see each other. We had public town squares and even the mall, and how that's receded from our culture in the past 30, 40 years. I mean, it's not fair to pin that just on the exurbs, because that's certainly true in the suburbs. It's true in the cities as well. But these megachurches are what scare me. And it seems like a very popular activity in exurbia are far right people trying to gain control of school boards and town councils and police departments, and making these little extreme right wing enclaves that are hotbeds of white grievance and conspiracy theory and paranoia. Is it rage, or is it resentment, or have these folks been groomed to be this angry?
Well, you know, you've done such profound work and commentary on the religious right, and I appreciate the work you've done on that subject matter. So you know this as well as I do, that the religious right began as a movement of exclusion and as a movement of segregation. The religious right sprang into politics in opposition to President Carter punishing Christian academies in the South that refused to admit refused to admit non-white students. So what we're seeing now is just another stage of that, and it's resentment against the progress that we've seen happen in this country in the past several decades, and then it's rage against the system that has made that progress possible and the people that flourish due to that progress. So here again, it's a little bit of all of the above,
right?
That they're groomed by people who certainly don't have their best interest in heart and don't have our democracy's best interest at heart, but they have those biases to begin with. So in that sense, they're easy marks.
How are they reflected in Congress? Who should we look at and think, oh, that's an exurbian representative?
Well, as I said, that's Jim Jordan, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Matt Gaetz.
favorites.
I mean, right. Those are the most lovable characters of Congress. And then in the Senate, I mean, J.D. Vance is in large part a product of the exurbs. In right-wing media, we have people like Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk is largely an exurban guy. Kyle Rittenhouse is from an exurb. And I know you asked about Congress, and I'm widening the net here.
Yeah,
but
no, it's fine. This is great.
the plotters and planners of the attempt to abduct and assassinate Gretchen Whitmer. Several of them were from Michigan exurbia. So it comes up over and over and over again when we look at some of the most dominant characters of the right wing. And this, too, has an interesting history. So in the 1990s, many of the most rabid, hateful members of Congress who really were responsible for making Congress much more extreme and partisan and rancorous, namely Newt Gingrich and Dennis Hastert, both represented exurban districts. So this has a long, dark, sordid history. And as you were kind enough to say when we started the program, it's essential to understand if you want to get a grasp on why our politics has become so strange and dysfunctional and what's going on as we head into the 2024 election.
Absolutely. The book is Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. And before I let you go, can I ask one more question? We've only got like a minute left, but don't the voting patterns of young Americans and the changes in the large metro suburbs indicate it's going to get more progressive in the future, whether they like it or not? I mean, the boomers are going to be the senior voters now, and we know that younger voters are not aligned with the values of what is currently the Republican Party. I mean, what's going to happen?
Yeah, if we can make it through this short-term danger, I think that in the long term, the future is bright, because the exurban right-wing movement, as I said earlier, is responsive. And it's not going to push back the tide. Younger Americans are progressive in greater numbers than any previous generation, and they're more involved in politics than any previous generation, even the much vaunted baby boomers. The United States of America is becoming much more diverse, and the right wing is becoming much more estranged. So, but the big thing to remember, as you know and your audience knows, the system in many ways works to the advantage of the right wing. The Electoral College, the skewed representation of the Senate, now the Supreme Court. So that makes participation at the local level, the state level, and the national level all the more vital going forward, so we can get the future that the majority of our countrymen and women want and demand.
David Mascriota is the author of the excellent and essential new book, Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. Thank you so much for joining us. This book is terrific, and I hope it makes a great Netflix documentary. I truly, truly do. I deeply enjoy the kind of research you're doing, and it made me have to reexamine a lot of communities I've lived in my life. Thank you so much for your time with us.
Oh, thank you. It was great.
We'll be right back in just a moment. We are at 866-997-4748. This is SiriusXM Progress.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
I'm John Fugelsang. This is Progress. We are at 866-997-4748. I want to get to as many of your calls as I can. Sean in Cali on line 3. Thank you for your patience. Welcome. You're on Progress.
Hey, Brother John. What a great show. You know,
OJ, I was going to comment on OJ because I remember exactly where I was. I was married 2 years at that point in time. I was actually having a fun day with three of my closest friends still today, since 7 years old. And we were playing golf. See, I used to play golf before kids. Anyway, and we're out at the course, and we did the turn, nine holes, and we came into the restaurant. This is in the East Bay, in the Bay Area. And it was on the TV, right? This is back when it wasn't like we had our phones or anything. And we're watching and watching. And we're like, what's going on? And everyone was telling us, he's accused of killing his wife and some boyfriend, right? And then I think it was CNN. It was probably CNN. And they were like, you know, and Al Cowlings is talking to the police and blah, blah, blah. And I don't remember if it was a Chiron or actually saying that they said O.J. wants to talk to his mother. And my friend turned to both of us. Oh, he did it. Yeah. He did it.
I know. Well, they had the suicide note that wasn't a suicide note. I mean, you know, OJ was falling apart until they surrounded him with lawyers who told him to take a different tack. And he did.
So, yeah, I mean, so my thing was, and I didn't even tell you the diversity of my foursome, but that's a joke in and of itself. But it was these are all very smart people who are just normal people. We all played on our baseball teams together and stuff. And when they heard that he wanted to talk to his mother, it's a common sense thing, right? I mean, we knew Al Cowlings was in crisis, right? He's trying to help his friend. But
Al Cowlings was in crisis?
No, but I'm saying, yeah, because he was trying to, what could he do? He didn't know whether, what's he going to do? He's just trying to, what can I do to save this moment? So, you know, I mean, I don't think he was a bad person. He's like, the guy has a gun in the back of the car, and this is a guy who's just killed his wife and the other guy, Mr. Yeah. Goldman, which is horrible. But let me just tell you, the whole thing is, with Rodney King and all that happening, you remember Daryl Gates, L.A., these are corrupt officers, these are a lot of them, and they killed black people, and they put them in prison for planting evidence, and they did plant evidence. They had the case, but they planted it. So I totally understand how black folks felt, even though I'm not black, because they had been screwed forever. That's the system.
I know, and I understand that. I understand the thrill of actually seeing a black man the cops try to frame, and he gets away with it. It's just, you know... Maybe not the best hero story. I mean, maybe your David and Goliath story needs a David who's not rich enough to buy enough lawyers to get away with murder.
No, but it's not a hero because so many white people got away with it a million times before that one time.
I know. And I also acknowledge it would have been scarier to me if they had convicted him because he was unconvictable in that trial.
No, but that's you mentioned that with the attorney's counselor, I think, and others. And by the way, he had the dream team. He had Trump doesn't have the dream team. Let me just tell you right now, he does not. But he has done an amazing job, and I mean Donald bin Laden, in delaying these cases because that's the whole key. He thinks he can probably win somehow and then get rid of all this stuff. That's his only strategy. But right now, he's going to trial, baby. He's going to trial.
And he's going to state trial, my friend. He can't pardon himself for this. No one can pardon him for this. He's going to have to I don't think he's going to get sentenced to jail time, but it is not going to go well for him. Sean, thank you so much for the call. I want to get to Dean in California, who's been on hold for a while. Dean, thank you for your patience. You're on Sirius XM.
Good evening. Yeah,
hey, good evening.
Back on Sean there.
Please do.
We're not being drenched in rain anymore, so that's good. But, I just happen to, just as another tie-in that I happen to have with the whole OJ thing. Back in the early 90s, straight out of school, I started working as a temp in the Fox studio because I thought, hey, this is a way to get my foot in the door.
Sure.
And so I actually worked for about 2 months in this brand new division called the Fox News Department.
Is this Fox Studio? Is this Fox Studio on Pico in L.A. or is this Fox? Is this Fox Television? Oh, okay, great. Go on, please.
No, we were not located inside the at West Pico. We were right outside in a building, a very small, nondescript kind of building, sitting just outside of the lot.
Okay,
but.
And what happened?
So here I am, and I'm literally brought in to help work the front desk. And, a couple of weeks into doing this, everybody is standing around looking at a bank of televisions in the lobby, and they're watching OJ apparently going up the highway in a Bronco. And, basically, they're all mumbling to each other, like, we got to get out there. What are we going to do? I mean, how can we go? And I just spoke up and I went, well, there's Palms. And they all turn and look at me like, Palms? Yeah, Palms Avenue. It's a bridge over 405. Doesn't have any on ramps or off ramps. So you could park your van right up. Before I could finish what I was saying, they went, come with us. Next thing you know, I'm in a van and driving to the bridge, the famous shot of this crowd of people on top of the bridge. Watching a swarm of slow motion chase.
Wow.
Heading north. So you can blame me for that if you want to know the truth.
Nice. Nice. Well, congratulations on that bit of pop culture history.
So it was a weird, bizarre experience to be there with a crowd of people cheering as this guy who had obviously, slain a couple of people.
What were they cheering exactly? Like, were they were,
the beginning
were they
of
just
tabloid
cheering the
journalism really took off.
That's it. They were cheering the beginning of this culture we live in now. They were there for the birth of it. I mean, I think it really began with the first Gulf War, but it got weaponized under OJ.
Yeah, and I'd say what's happened now is we've transitioned. Those tabloid journalism shows really don't have that kind of muscle anymore. Regular news, Fox News has taken that style, and they blurred the line between reality and sensationalism, and that's where it really took off.
You're so right, Dean. I thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you, and I agree. This was what started this kind of culture, but it's amazing to think, like, I always defended all the coverage of OJ on the level that this was the most famous American who was ever put on trial for murder. I mean, that's noteworthy, right? Like, Fatty Arbuckle, I mean, there'd never been a more famous American citizen to have a murder trial. So in that sense, I did think it was valid. But of course, now, how interesting that he dies on the eve of the first ever criminal trial for a former American president. The machine that was created around the O.J. Simpson trial will be in full force for the rest of our summer over his fellow celebrity Donald Trump's. 866-997-4748. Howard in South Dakota, thank you for waiting on hold, sir. You're on Sirius XM. Hello.
Hello, John. It's South Carolina.
Oh, South Carolina. Well, that's cool, too. Welcome.
All right. I was stationed at Great Lakes, Illinois, when the OJ thing happened. I was in my barracks room watching the basketball game because I had some money on it. And then they went to the chase. And then we went to the barracks the open building where they had the driver's lounge. The lounge, we went down there, and then we went to the base club. Then we ended up going to Flanagan's to watch it. And they had on the corner.
Hmm.
I remember when all that stuff was going down. And to me,
crazy.
I think OJ did it. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't talk. Because if I was up there and I was accused of killing two white people, I'd be screaming from the top of the mountains, "Hey, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I didn't do it."
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? We'll never know the truth because they never. It's a cold case because they never. After the OJ trial, they never went to see who really killed them people.
Yeah, I don't think we ever will know. And I've always thought if OJ wasn't behind it, I always thought he did know who did do it. Now it seems unlikely we'll ever get that answer. But again, it's still going to be interesting. There will be more NDAs revealed.
Yeah, I hear you, John. I hear you. Thank you for taking my call, and I love the show.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. Have a great evening. 866-997-GRIT. This just in. Evan Corcoran, Donald Trump's attorney, who was a critical witness in the classified documents case. He's the lawyer that Donald Trump lied to and said, "I turned everything in. Go look in the basement." But he had Walt Nauta secretly moved the boxes and deliberately sent his lawyer on a wild goose chase? Evan Corcoran has quietly left Donald Trump's legal team. This comes from Caitlin Collins. Really going to be an interesting summer, everybody. Ooh. Let me get one more call in before the break, and then we'll get to Simon and Julie in the next hour. Quamel from California, thank you so much for waiting on hold. You're on Progress.
Well, hello there.
Hello.
My fine long-haired friend.
I got a lot of it cut off. I'm not as long-haired as I used to be, but thank you. How you doing?
All right. Yeah. I was actually looking forward to this particular segment before our Indigenous friends come along, because I was looking forward to what decent birthdays you would have had lined up. Come to find you didn't mention any. And I'm like, damn, because today is my birthday. And I'm like,
yeah, today's your birthday. No way. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
Like,
you got a good one.
I'm like, there's no good celebrity birthdays that
yes,
go
there
with
are.
It.
Yes, there are. You are born on the same day as the guy who wrote Silence of the Lambs. You are born on the same day as Carl Franklin, who made One False Move, one of my favorite directors. You're born on the same day Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1968, goddammit. You're born on the same day that Academy Award winner and friend of this show, Joel Grey, was born. Joel Grey was up for Best Supporting Actor for Cabaret. You know who he was up against? Everybody in The Godfather was up for Best Supporting Actor. James Caan and Al Pacino and Robert Duvall and Joel Grey beat them all. And today he turns 92. Bro, you got a really cool birthday. You win.
I don't know. It's just hard because every time I look him up, I'm like, I look James up, and I'm like, okay, there's not a lot. I mean, I saw that Lisa Stansfield, you know.
Lisa Stansfield, cool. That, dude,
guess, or,
Jackie Robinson became the first black player in Major League history on this date in 1947. He played an exhibition game for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Come on now. The Americans liberated the concentration camp Buchenwald on this date in 1945. You got an awesome fucking birthday. They finished building the Empire State Building on April 11th, 1901. God damn, you got a good birthday.
See, now you're about to turn me into Mitch and Ken State over here, because I'm like, okay, I'm thinking maybe there's like Joss Stone. I heard her birthday was today.
Joss Stone. She's awesome.
And the rapper and activist and lecturer David Banner.
Yes, you know, that renowned guy. Renowned poet David Banner.
I'm struggling to find some others. I don't know, Morgan Fairchild. Maybe I might be wrong with that one.
Del DeFunco, Homo Sapien, released Both Sides of the Brain on this date 24 years ago. Come on now.
Yes.
The soundtrack. Okay, you ready for this? You ready for this? The soundtrack to Friday was released 29 years ago today.
It used to be a very good have girlies come over type movie too.
There you go. So you have hip hop cred now. You have hip hop cred. I can't do more for you, sir. I've given you the civil rights movement. I've given you the Beatles. I've given you Jackie Robinson and the Empire goddamn State Building. And Singing in the Rain opened this day, too. So one of the best movies of all time. Your birthday rules, man. I share a birthday with Charlie Sheen. I got nothing.
Hey, I mean, it's not your fault, because I guess there's more dope people that need to be born on this day. That's just all it is. I can't stand them. Anyways, yes. I got nothing political. Just wanted to you know, rag.
Happy birthday, my friend. I'm honored to spend a few minutes of it with you. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you for your time.
Have a great one. We're at 866-997-GRID. Quick break. We'll be right back with Simon Moya-Smith and Julie Francella. This is SiriusXM.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you. And welcome back. So we talked quite a bit yesterday about Joe Biden trying to do shit, namely with a student loan debt forgiveness. And it's very exciting. 30 million Americans could have their lives get a lot easier. Coincidentally, just before Election Day, and we're glad about that. That's really groovy. But even as it's about to relieve up to 30 million people from this debt, a lot of people who aren't indigenous seem to think that indigenous people get to go to college tuition free. Like somehow reparations happened and we never announced it. I am so pleased to welcome two of my favorite people here to correct some misapprehensions. Simon Moya-Smith is an Oglala Lakota and Chicano journalist. He's a contributing writer at NBC's and The Nation. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Your Spirit Animal is a Jackass, and an adjunct professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Colorado, Denver. Simon, welcome back.
Lovely to be here, man.
It's great to have you. Julie Francella is an activist, artist, writer, superhero, and veteran mental health professional with over 28 years of experience working with complex trauma in the clinical field, executive director of a domestic violence center, and spent 13 years as a clinical caseworker at a residential treatment center for Indigenous youth and families. She's an enrolled member of the Ojibwe Abachawana First Nation Reserve and currently works with the First Nations University of Canada and is a professor at Durham College, where she teaches about the profound impacts of colonization on First Nations people. Julie, it's so good to have you back.
Thank you for having us. We're so happy to be here.
Thank you. So I wanted to talk to you guys about student loan forgiveness because it's great. And it to me, it's terrific. These young people and middle-aged people should stop being slaves to banks for student loan debt. And now they can start being slaves to banks for home mortgage debt. It's all really groovy. But it's amazing how there's this misconception that somehow Indians go to school for free in this country. Where did this come from? I mean, that's what reparations would look like. That's what we're all waiting for.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, with President Biden's initiative to alleviate the burden of student loans for millions of young Americans, I mean, that's incredible. And I'm 100% behind that. But, you know, you're right. There's a common misconception that persists that casts a shadow over the financial realities of Native American students. And it is true that it's widely believed that all Native students attend college tuition free. But that is so far from the truth. You know, well, there are some tribes that have education programs. You know, they're often underfunded and restrictive, covering only a fraction of the costs associated with higher education, if there's even any funding available at all. So, yeah, Simon?
Well, shit, man. I mean, how many stereotypes are there of natives, right? So
yeah.
I hate the idea that people really think that we go to college for free. No, we can't just walk into Harvard. We can't just walk into Yale and just say, hey, I'm indigenous, and, you know, provide them maybe our enrollment numbers and et cetera. And they're like, oh, yeah, come on in, sit down. Don't worry about it. That's not how that works. What started was the university. There were small colleges for natives. For example, Dartmouth was founded as an Indian college. And so there are many colleges across the United States specifically that were there to educate indigenous people for free. So, no, we can't just walk into any college we want to, but these stereotypes continue. Like the one, we don't pay taxes. That's something that people still believe, that we don't pay taxes, or that every Native American is rich from casinos. Bullshit. That's not how that works. We get checks from the government. I haven't got a single check from the fucking government. And so we have to understand, like right now, even I'm saddled with immense student debt from Columbia. And so because of that, I struggle to buy a house. And so I'm not the only person of color who believes this. For indigenous people specifically, I don't think that we should have to pay tuition on stolen land. You stole our fucking land. You stole the land. Yeah. So we don't have that intergenerational wealth because the white people took our land. And the least they can do, if they're not going to give the land back, is at least let indigenous people go to college for free. But that's not what's happening right now. There are so many indigenous people out there, like you said, young people, middle-aged people who are really struggling with student debt.
That's right. And I completely agree. I think step one of any conversation about reparations for descendants of slaves or First Nations citizens has to be healthcare for life
and free college. That's the easiest thing our government could do. Could do that right away and begin providing those services just as a gesture, as a way to begin to right centuries of wrongs. Julie?
I agree. It's a meaningful act of reparation, and it does acknowledge there's a unique status of Native people. And, you know, in light of the historical and ongoing impacts of colonization, I think that would be something. I paid my student loans off, but I had student loans, and it's rough out there. So I'm so happy for everybody out there, all the students out there right now who this applies to, who are getting their student loans forgiven. I think that's wonderful. Think that I agree with Simon that there should some free education, free tuition, free college and university for Indigenous students. The land that these institutions are built upon, you know, is technically stolen land. So
absolutely. And not to go down a cul-de-sac, but I mean, this all comes back to the white grievance of the majority. All of this, the notion that someone is getting something free, and it doesn't matter how many times you explain to them, no, their educations are paid for. This is the interest. The interest is the racket. The interest is how these people are kept as wage slaves. Their college degrees were paid for years ago. They're still paying off the interest, and yet anyone else getting help will make a certain kind of American feel like something has been taken away from them. We have a bunch of... Yeah. Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Well,
Simon.
Yeah, and it's not even about the free, but doing the right thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? You're not just giving something away that's, you know, you're just correcting a wrong that was done. And they're not going to give the island of Manhattan back to the Indigenous people. They're not going to give the state of California back to the Indigenous people. But the least they can do is to make sure that the Indigenous people who are here aren't completely struggling just to pay a bill a month. I mean, if anybody has ever taken out Pell Grants, anything through the United States government, you can pay it, your bill can be as much as an apartment. And if you haven't had student loans, right now they are really horrendous, and a lot of people can't pay them because they're like, okay, well, income based repayment, well, your bill's still going to be $600. And so it really people really struggle, and again, Indigenous people specifically struggle because everybody thinks that we go to school for free. They truly believe that.
It's crazy. Guys, we have a lot of listeners who want to weigh in and say hello tonight. Do you want to talk to some of our evil army of the night?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go to Tim in Chicago on line 4. Tim, thank you so much for your patience on hold. You're on with Simon and Julie. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Julie and Simon. I'm so honored to be speaking with you. And John, you too by proxy, I guess. I don't think I missed a single segment since you've become regulars. And I just, I love how you guys have the perfect, you know, 1-2 punch of just compassion, education, and then just straight talk, where you're able to just grab people by the proverbial head and hit them over the upside and say, stop being such a moron. So good on you both.
They have a good cop, bad cop thing here in this chemistry that is amazing to me. But yes, go on, please.
No, it is fantastic. So I did want to revisit a subject from one of your more recent segments, the Chicago Blackhawks, my hometown team. But since we're talking NHL, I did want to take a moment and acknowledge the very tragic and very recent passing of Chris Simon, a former NHL player. And Julie, if you don't mind, I'll kindly pass the mic to you, because I understand he was a fairly prominent figure in Ojibwe circles.
Mm.
Yes. He actually was from an area where I'm from, and he brought a lot of, he brought so much respect to Indigenous people. And it was so sad to know and to learn that he had taken his own life. And, you know, I did a post about that. I don't know if you know, but Indigenous people have the highest rates of suicide. It's very personal to me. I'd lost my own sister to suicide. So when we have somebody that is so prominent and in, you know, sort of the public eye that way, have them, you know, die in that way, it's just another Indigenous person that, you know, we've lost, and it's so sad. And I was really upset about losing him. I know that he represented a lot of us out there. You know, whenever one of us is able to kind of bring some positivity out there as an Indigenous person, it really helps, you know, the rest of us to kind of break those stereotypes. And so it was really, really sad for us to lose someone from our community that way.
There's another stereotype here at play as well. I mean, Chris Simon was publicly struggling with CTE symptoms because the NHL is the last professional sports league that denies a link between repetitive head trauma and neurodegenerative disease. So his family certainly says that it is because of the play and the head injuries that led to his problems. And of course, the NHL doesn't want to hear it. And they disavow any kind of link between blows to the head and CTE.
I just remember when I was reading a Sports Illustrated article and they did a profile of him back in the late 90s. And he was just this magnificent figure, had his hair all the way down to his back and just these fierce eyes. And, you know, I was obviously awestruck, always kind of kept tabs on him since he was a journeyman in the NHL. I had a very, storied career. So when I recently found out that he had tragically passed, you know, my heart and condolences out to all his, you know, community and friends and loved ones. So thank you for your thank you for informing us on that, Joey. So I did have two questions about the Blackhawks. I've written about the team for various publications over the years, not just, game recaps, but about the franchise itself. And I'm curious as to just what the current state is on the relationship with the organization and First Nations communities, because on the one hand, I see Fox and Sauk Nation representatives that are actively working with the Blackhawks, and Blackhawks have tried to be proactive, as you both know, throughout the past 15, and especially within the last 5 years, of engaging First Nations communities. And so you have certain representatives that are working with them to kind of overcome that major obstacle that you both have identified repeatedly, and which is just to be seen. But on the other hand, you have other organizations within the First Nations communities that have, kind of disavowed their working relationship with the Blackhawks. And Julie, to your point, have said, we're not going to be your moral dry cleaners to, get rid of all the baggage your namesake brings. So
right on.
I was just curious if you could update us on, kind of the state of affairs between First Nations communities and the Blackhawks.
Sure. So unfortunately, they are doing a lot of what the Washington football team did, and they do a lot of what the Kansas City Chiefs do. They're just like, we're honoring you. So they'll have Native American Day, and they'll try to connect with Indian centers. And but when you have other organizations going to them and say, hey, look, it's been empirically proven, demonstrably proven, that these logos, the language, harms the mental health and stability of children. And they just turned a blind eye to that. So it's kind of like what Wells Fargo did during the Standing Rock fight. They tried to bring in other nations and tried to throw shit tons of money at the problem. And then didn't, and in that way, they were trying to demonstrate that they were for the people. But again, we're going to them and we're saying, like, look, here's the science. Your mascots dehumanize Indigenous people. It caricaturizes Indigenous people. There are, and it harms the mental health and stability of children. How do we, how can we say this any clearer? And so they continue to throw money. They try to bring on tribes. They try to bring on Indian centers, student groups, whatever, just to show that, oh no, they say it's okay. But again, just like with the Washington football team, just because you have a Native friend that doesn't have a problem with it doesn't mean it's not problematic. And that's where you find a lot of folks that, again, you'll find some Natives going, I don't care. But at the end of the day, I don't care if a Native doesn't care. This is harming the mental health and stability of children.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree 100% with Simon. You know, just because it doesn't affect you personally or you're not taking personal offense to it as a Native person, that's not to say that it is not causing damage to some of us who, maybe don't have the resources that you have or don't have, whatever it is out there that allows you to not be impacted by these things. So it's really important. I worked with kids for many, many years, and it really was bothersome and it really was difficult to address some of these things because it was impacting, their self-esteem. And, so I think it's important to remember that if it affects one person, if one person out there is saying that, this isn't okay, it should, we should listen to that. And I think that that's sort of what's happening with some of these other teams is that they're listening to that. And I think it just, it reflects this broader discussion about sports in America, especially, and Canada as well, but the use of Native American names and imagery, I think it's just, it shouldn't be done.
I remember being a teenager watching the mascot Chief Nakahoma for the Braves, and my brother and I were so embarrassed, and our friends thought we were ridiculous for finding that offensive.
That's stupid. I mean, again, remember,
well,
Indian mascots also
open
the door to racist behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
I do appreciate you bringing to my attention the recent legislation they passed in Illinois about the Scholastic mascots, because that's not getting a lot of press here.
That
said, I do think that the Blackhawks namesake is on borrowed time. So my second question would be, in terms of what the next name should be in the next logo, and a lot of people don't know that the Blackhawks aren't named directly after Chief Blackhawk per se. They're named after the 86th Infantry Division, which was the World War One division of the original owner.
Yeah.
And that the insignia for that is just a silhouette of a Blackhawk. So my question to both of you would be then, would that be a reasonable substitute? So they'd still be called the Blackhawks, but just have a silhouette of a Blackhawk, the bird.
Yeah, if it's a bird, it's a bird. It has nothing to do with indigenous people. Yeah. I mean, at that point, again, like the Ravens, that was after Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. So, that's fine. Just the whole idea of playing Indian, just stay the fuck away from it, please. Even Halloween, Thanksgiving, sports mascots, stay the fuck away from it.
Right on. Tim, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate it.
John, if I could, I just want to mention, Julie, you mentioned lacrosse. I'm a former lacrosse player. I played D3 in college. It's an amazing sport. It's so viewer friendly, and my fantasy, it's sci-fi at this point, but I would love for it to get its act together on the national level. Right now it's a hodgepodge of indoor and outdoor leagues, but I would love to see a national lacrosse league that the teams take their names from the nomenclature of indigenous tribes from their their geographic location. So for example, a lacrosse team in Chicago would be named after Algonquin terminology. Right. I mean, I hope that's not offensively naive, but I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
We got to see the mascots first.
The Haudenosaunee has their own, I think they're going to the Olympics under their own flag. So there's, some movement around that.
Nice. Hey,
well, thank you,
Tim, what a pleasure to hear from you. Thank you so much. It's really great to hear from you. I'm incredibly white, so I'm starting a high-lie league. Let me get one more call in here. Frank in Georgia has been on hold forever as well. Frank, welcome. You're on with Simon and Julie.
Hey, John, Simon, Julie. Good to talk with you.
Hi, Frank.
Hello. You guys on X. Hey. And I think Instagram, too. I buried the lead. First of all, it is my birthday. And
today's your birthday? I'm sorry. Today's your birthday?
Yes, it is.
Happy birthday. So you got to hear all the great things that happened on your day already. Welcome.
Yes, well, I'm not going to bitch at all. Okay. I appreciate that. I appreciate that front-loading that for us.
Happy birthday.
I live in Muskogee County in Columbus, Georgia. And I was telling Thea that I read the Secret History of the United States or America by Tennessee Davis.
Mm-hmm. And
apparently Isabella sent a pack of pigs with Columbus when he came.
Yeah, Queen Isabella.
And so that was kind of like, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but that was like biological warfare. Eventually they had to know that was causing the problem of smallpox and the other various diseases. What I'm interested in, Fort Benning is next door to Columbus, and now it's been renamed Fort Moore. So I'm wondering how long it's going to take to get Columbus changed to something like maybe the Fountain City. That's one of our nicknames. There's some wonderful people in Columbus. It's a great town, a long town, but the name.
No, it's true. I mean, but I don't see it happening in our lifetimes. I see statues being taken down, but the names of cities, Simon and Julie, what do you think?
Well, Columbus, Ohio, of course, that I don't know if that's ever going to change. And again, in our lifetime, like you said, but really quickly to go back when you were talking about pigs and how Queen Isabella sent them with Christopher Columbus. Well, there were some unintended consequences to that. And it's just like some of the untouched tribes today, that one specifically that's protected by the country of India. So, for example, if you guys want to read this, there's some amazing books. Charles Mann wrote a book called 1493, and then he wrote a book called 1491. So pre-Columbus and after Columbus. Well, what happened was with pigs, a pig would escape some with, you know, from a white person's farm and then would end up eating some of the food, maybe some corn that indigenous people picked. And then they would eat it and get sick. Because they didn't have any way to fight off what, of course, the diseases that Europeans brought. So that, and in that case, that, you know, of course, that was just a pig taking off. These weren't smallpox blankets, but smallpox blankets did happen.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wow.
But I mean, we got a statue of Columbus on the Riverwalk. You know, on the Chattahoochee River. You know, we're just surrounded by Native American culture. You know, the Creek and Choctaws, and you know, Ucotoy Creek, Kitchibuni Creek. You know, all these beautiful Apalachee rivers. You know, all these Native American names, and then you've got, you know, the Indian Mounds and things like that in Georgia. I love the history of it. But I hate that that Trail of Tears thing and what the Chief Justice said, you know, and what Andrew Jackson said, you know, well, my army's not gonna follow your decision here.
It's monstrous. You know, and any president who would admire Andrew Jackson is ignorant at best and a monster at worst.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and the statues are going to come down, dude. The statues will come down. They are already coming down. There was one here in Santa Fe. They're coming down.
Yeah, and the Confederates to follow. Hey, thanks for the call, man. Yeah. I really appreciate it, Frank. It's good to hear from you. I would be most remiss if I didn't talk about another very sad passing and something that is beginning to spark some real genuine outrage. The mysterious death of actor Cole Brings Plenty. Now, Cole Brings Plenty is the nephew of an actor on Yellowstone, and he appeared in a couple of episodes of 1923, Julie, which was a terrific show.
Yes.
He was very young, and he has been found dead, and the circumstances are very dark and very mysterious. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, you know, it's still under investigation, and, you know, Cole Brings Plenty. It's just this tremendous loss. You know, he's a very talented actor. You know, John, as you mentioned, he was in 1923. And it's right now they are looking at, I think it's believed that he may have taken his own life, but that's not necessarily
right.
What the evidence is showing. But what they're now saying, there's been some reports saying that he was at a concert and his hair got caught in a microphone stand.
Oh.
And what had happened was there was a woman apparently who, without his consent, took a pair of scissors and cut his hair off. And if you know...
That's what I had
heard.
If
you know what he looks like, he has very long hair, usually in braids. And so I guess the story goes that this woman was the one that he went to see after, maybe confronted her. I'm not sure. I think that they knew each other. And apparently there was an incident and the police were called. And he, I guess, went missing shortly after. And there's some talk of domestic violence. And so I'm not sure exactly what happened. But it's really sad.
I mean, once again, you guys have done so much to educate our listeners about how much value and strength is in hair. And there's a photo online of this happening at this mosh pit where his hair gets caught in the mic, as you said, Julie, but then someone just comes up behind and takes a pair of scissors and takes it upon themselves to hack it all off, which in itself is an unspeakable violation. Yeah.
Yeah. And also this person apparently was known to him. And so you know, was it deliberate? Was it, I'm not sure. I don't want to start, you know, putting ideas out there, but this is what's sort of going around right now. And there actually was a movement called Braids for Cole, where people were, you know,
yes,
braiding their hair in his honor to find out exactly what happened.
And once again, it's another case of an Indigenous person who goes missing, turns up dead, and no one knows. It's just the fact that he was on a couple of TV shows means that people are actually paying attention a little bit.
Yeah, that's what people were saying, that was pretty fucked up, you know, because we have murdered and missing Indigenous peoples, murdered and missing Indigenous women and Two-Spirits. And then, you know, they find him really quickly. And they were like, OK, can you continue to do this? Can you continue to find our relatives and our elders? And then, you know, his funeral's this weekend up in South Dakota. He's Lakota like I am. He's Minikonju. Mm-hmm. I'm Oglala. And it's really important, again, to reemphasize the significance of Indigenous people's hair. You know, this isn't just a look. This is very spiritual. It's very cultural. It's very sacred to us.
Yeah.
We can cut our hair if we want, or we can wear it long. It's totally up to us. But ancestrally, historically, our memory was in our hair. Our memory is in our hair. It's a representation of us as our nations, our tribes, our elders, and in honor of those who weren't allowed to have long hair, the ones that were kidnapped and taken to boarding schools and had their hair cut against their will. Yeah. So it's extremely important for people to understand that if you do see an Indigenous person, please don't just come up and touch their hair. It is part of their body. It is part of their person. It is extremely sacred. Don't do that. It's, you know, again, like Julie was saying, it to cut off an Indigenous person's hair against their will is an assault. And again, we mourn a loss. He was only 27. He was a kid, man.
Yeah.
And so we lost a young, bright Indigenous boy. I'm going to call him a boy, 27. Yeah, we'll call them man. But he was a young man. He was a boy. Yeah. And we lost another Lakota who, again, for us, we're the smallest racial minority in our homeland. And we're trying to protect our youth and our young people as much as we can. And this is again, one of those stories that if you guys look it up, all the details aren't out there yet. But this is another assault on an Indigenous person.
Hmm. We have to take another break. Before we go, I do want to say the Cheyenne River Sioux are demanding an investigation because the police have still not yet released the cause of death for Cold Springs Plenty. We only got a couple minutes. I want to get one more call in if we can get it really tight. Russ in Idaho. Welcome, Russ. You're on with Simon and Julie. If you can make it really quick.
Oh, boy. I will try.
Okay.
So I'm going to say, first of all, thanks for not taking my call last week, because I called in last week and I wouldn't have got through it. But I want to say content warning on this, too, for anyone who is not aware of this situation. And if you search it, you're going to see some fucked up pictures and read some fucked up accounts of what happened. But in Wyoming, on the last day of February, there's this scumbag, and I'm sorry, I'm going to be cursing a lot.
That's okay.
There's this scumbag. He chased down a wolf. He was on his snowmobile, and he ran it over. It turns out it's illegal to, quote-unquote, hunt with vehicles in Wyoming. He maimed this wolf. He captured it. He stole it out of the woods. He taped its mouth shut.
He
brought it home. He brought it to a bar.
Tortured
he
it.
Took pictures with it. And then he took it out back and murdered it.
Yeah.
And for all that, he got a $250 citation for transporting a live wolf.
God.
And just to give people context, and I'm sorry, like I'm kind of running through this real quick.
It's okay. Name's Cody Roberts, by the way. This douchebag's name is Cody Roberts. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can look it up.
Yes. Folks. So I wasn't going to say his name because apparently there's a few other people in the state with that name who are getting death threats
fair
right
enough.
Now, which is not helpful.
So, sorry. I just have rage towards this guy. I knew this story.
Yeah, I get it, John. Like, I want to, like, fucking say his name. But just to give people context, fishing without a license, the maximum penalty in Wyoming is a $10,000 fine and a year in jail. This guy got a $250 citation. Obviously, there's a shit ton of outrage right now about this. The governor says that hunting laws are going to change. These hunting laws have been a fucking problem there for a long time, and maybe they'll change, but this is not a hunting story. And the reason I wanted to call in and talk to you guys about this is to provide some information. There is a, and I think your listeners are the people who will be outraged and take action on this. There's a petition at Wyoming Wildlife Advocates. That's their that's their Instagram,
right.
And on their link tree, you could digitally sign a petition, or you could go to WyomingWildlifeAdvocates.org. And this petition is putting pressure on Sublette County sheriffs and Sublette County prosecutors to bring felony charges to this guy. And just if anyone's out there asking, like, who would do this? So after this started getting...
Russ, I'm so sorry, but we're almost out of time, and I want to give Simon and Julie a chance to, in our final minute, comment on this very important story. Mm-hmm. Guys, I'm sorry we're not going to have a Did You Know, but Simon and Julie, do you have any thoughts on this appalling abomination?
Go ahead, Julie.
I do. I mean, hunting in essence for us isn't a conquest, but it is a profound dialogue with nature, a practice intertwined with respect, balance, and the understanding that every life taken is a life that sustains another. This kind of act is an abomination to the balance of our, you know, nature and life here on the planet that we share with these creatures. I think that, John, you sent a story to us about whales getting the same rights as a person. I think that all of our relatives, animals, should have the same rights as a person to avoid things like this.
Julie, how do we follow you?
Julie Francella on Instagram and on Twitter.
Simon, I'm going to give you the last 40 seconds. Your thoughts?
Yeah, white people came here and started hunting for fun. And white people hunt for fun. We don't for fun. Wolves... all animals, they are our relatives. That's why in my language, it's Mitakweo Yasin. To all my relations, everything from the birds in the sky to the fish in the water and to the four-leggeds that run around us. So I guess the last two things I'd say is, fuck. I won't go that far, but yeah, fuck that guy.
Simon, thank you so much. Julie, thank you so much. And Russ, thank you for that call in the end. Guys, we'll start at the top of the hour next week and get to even more. Thank you both so much. Everybody follow these two on social media. This is SiriusXM. I'm John Fugelsang. Peace.